Welcome to Moving Medicine, a podcast by the American Medical Association. Today's episode is part one of a two-part series facilitated by Dr. Willie Underwood, chair of the AMA Board of Trustees. He's joined by a panel of AMA attorneys to discuss the key advocacy issues at the state level. Panelists include Michaela Sternstein, Vice President of the AMA Advocacy Resource Center, or ARC. Also, senior attorneys Daniel Blaney Cohen, Emily Carroll, and Kimberly Horvath. Be sure to tune in to part two of this conversation in a few weeks and subscribe to AMA Moving Medicine on your favorite podcast platform. Here's Dr. Underwood.
Thank you for joining us today. Hi, I'm Dr. Willie Underwood, board chair of the AMA and urologist in upstate New York. It is my pleasure to be the host of this morning's session that we've titled The State of the States, because it will examine some of the most important issues playing out in states across the country as the new state legislative sessions kick off. Scope of practice, prior authorization, physician burnout and wellness. Each of these issues impact physicians, affect our healthcare systems, and they jeopardize the quality of care that patients receive. So we need to address them, we need to understand them, we need to talk about them. So what's being done about them? What does effective state-level advocacy look like? What does legislators and regulators need from physicians to better understand these issues? And importantly, what tools, resources, support does the AMA offer to help states and specialty medical societies confront these challenges and improve patient care in their home states? Welcome, panelists. Let's get started. Kai, let's set the scene. All right. We are right now. Most states have kicked off their legislative session. Some are halfway through. Some are almost done. How are these topics we're focused on today fitting into state legislators and those priority issues in most states?
Thank you, Dr. Underwood, and hello, everyone. Such an honor to be here with such a wonderful physician like Dr. Underwood and my incredible teammates here in the Advocacy Resource Center. Well, it won't be surprising to most to hear that these three issues that we're focusing on today land right in the top priority issues for state medical associations across the country. When the AMA identified the recovery plan and the issues included in the recovery plan after surveying physicians across the country, for the AMA, it was not surprising for us in advocacy to see the issues that were listed. These are the issues that we primarily work on day in and day out in collaboration and cooperation with state medical associations across the country. So we're excited to bring you our thinking, our expertise, our knowledge on these three issues. Of course, we in the ARC cover a whole gamut of issues that go beyond these three. We are the resource center for medicine across the country, and we're proud of the work that we do and the wonderful relationships that we have with state medical associations, every single one in this country.
Awesome. Awesome. And I tell you, I can verify that. They work very hard to make sure that physicians are heard, represented, and state and specialty societies have the resources that they need. But also, we also work hand in hand with state medical associations, not only on legislative solutions, but also on regulatory solutions. So Kai, how do you go about impacting the work of regulators in the states?
So this is actually an interesting spot for us, and I think a real sweet spot for the AMA, something that we can bring to the table that many state associations on their own cannot. So we have, in the last many years, focused on national policymaking organizations that represent the regulators in the states. For example, the National Association of Attorneys General, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the National Governors Association. So every regulator that's in the state belongs to a national organization that represents their interests. Many of these organizations put out policy, put out model legislation, put out guidance to their constituents. We have worked very, very hard to create an environment where we and the voice of physicians and patients are respected and heard and desired when it comes to issues. We've created an environment, thanks to the folks that are on this call, where we have become a trusted source to have these organizations know that they can tap into us on trends that are happening across the country. What issues should we be looking at? What do patients think? We have connections and deep relationships with patient organizations across the country. We bring them to the table. If there's something happening in the state of Texas or the state of Nebraska, we can bring medical associations to the table. We can bring physician leaders to the table to ensure that voices are heard. This wasn't always the case. And I'm really, really proud of this work, because when we influence the policymaking process with these national organizations, we touch all 50 regulators in one fell swoop. And then we can go in with the 1-2 punch with our state medical associations and follow up like we do, always trying to get that win. You like that, Dr. Underwood. We're always looking to get that win for medicine and for patients, for physicians, and we're relentless in that regard. And I think our work is really paying off.
I agree. And thinking about wins, when we look at our three issues that we're discussing today, prior authorization, scope of practice, physician wellness, let's hear from Daniel, Emily, and Kim. So what have you seen happening on these issues in the past years or so with the states? And where do things stand right now in the state legislature? I'm going to go with Daniel, then I want to go to Emily and Kim.
Thank you, Dr. Underwood. I think when we're talking about physician wellness, I think it's first to be really clear that what the AMA is talking about is, you know, are multiple areas. And, you know, and Kim and Emily are going to talk more about this, but it ranges from, you know, reducing administrative burdens such as prior authorization to supporting medical students and residents at every stage in their career. There are stressors and issues at every stage in a physician's career. For the purpose of today's discussion, however, I think when we talk about state and national advocacy efforts, I want to focus on two areas. One is the AMA advocacy encouraging state medical boards, hospitals, and health systems to remove stigmatizing and inappropriate language on their licensing and credentialing applications that mandate disclosure of past mental health or substance use disorder treatment. Such treatment that does not pose a current threat to patient safety or a physician's ability to provide safe, competent medical care. And second, and this is just as important, but once boards, hospitals, and health systems and other credentialing organizations remove those inappropriate questions, there's a real important need to communicate those changes across the system to all physicians and other licensees to ensure that they know they're not going to be punished or they're not going to be required to disclose past treatment and have it be used against them in licensing and credentialing situations. So let me be even more clear, Dr. Underwood. The AMA is encouraging every state medical board, every hospital and health system, professional liability carrier, insurance company, credentialing organization in the country, remove all questions on those applications about whether an applicant received care in the past or had past diagnosis or treatment of a mental illness or substance use disorder that does not represent a current impairment to safely and competently practice medicine. And the great news, Dr. Underwood, is that we have worked with many organizations ranging from the Federation of State Medical Boards, the Dr. Lorna Breen Heroes Foundation, to make dozens of changes across medical boards and health systems that positively affect literally hundreds of thousands of physicians across the country. A lot more work to do, a lot of success we've already had.
Yes. And that's extremely important. I mean, you think about it. Well, I don't want to get care today because I'm going to have to explain it for the rest of my career. That really, you know, doesn't make any sense. No, I need help today. So let me get help today. And I let that impede my ability to be a great physician tomorrow. That's excellent work.
Medicine doesn't stand still, and neither do we. AMA members don't just keep up with medicine. They shape its future. Help move medicine. Join the movement. Visit AMA-ASSN.org moving medicine.
Emily.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Underwood. And so happy to be here. I'm going to quickly talk about sort of what's going on with prior authorization in the states. I think, you know, most folks on the call will understand how high a priority this is for our colleagues in the state medical associations on their advocacy agendas every year, because it is a growing burden for sure on patients and physicians. When I started doing this work probably, you know, a decade ago on prior authorization, we were talking about standardizing the question sets and, you know, doing a single form for prior authorization. And now we're talking about such massive reform because the process has gotten so out of control. Our colleagues over in our administrative simplification department, initiatives department, they do a survey every year, and the results are always just really alarming. The patient impact, we find that 33% of physicians report harm to a patient, hospitalization, death, impairment because of prior authorization, and then the impact on physician practices, the resource waste, and the time that physicians are having to spend on paperwork rather than caring for their patients is just a growing problem. So with that, we have really been working in the states to kind of switch the narrative on prior authorization to really start focusing on volume reduction and making the process faster, easier, and only used very judiciously, and not on every pharmaceutical and service that's prescribed. So kind of where we are in the states, I think the momentum over the last couple of years has been surprising even for us who know how big a problem this is. Last year, we saw upwards of 70 bills introduced in the states. Some of those were bills that were really, you know, broad prior authorization reform efforts. Some of them were very targeted over one issue or one service that maybe a legislator had experienced a bad outcome as a result of that prior authorization on a service. And we've had 10 bills pass at the state level last year. This year, even more bills. We have almost 100 bills in the state that we're tracking right now. And we've already had a couple this year pass. I think we're up to 3 already. So it's really great progress. We're working really closely with the states, and I'm you know, cautiously optimistic that it's going to be another great year for the states in terms of prior authorization reform.
All right. I'm up next. Hi, everyone. I'm going to talk about scope of practice. And last year, we saw a huge number of scope bills introduced across the states, really more than any other year that we can remember. From the organized medicine perspective, I will say that last year was very successful. There were a couple losses here or there, but overall, it was a successful year. As Kai mentioned at the outset, all of these issues are top priorities for the AMA and state medical associations and national specialty societies that we work with day in and day out. And it's no surprise that scope continues to top that list year after year. It is also no surprise to anybody on this call that scope bills continue to be introduced in state legislatures across the country, even in those states where legislators have repeatedly said no and they've defeated scope legislation. We continue to see them come back year after year. Similar to last year, we are seeing an increase in pharmacist test-to-treat bills. These are bills that would allow pharmacists to diagnose and treat a patient based simply on the results of a CLIA waived test and then prescribe medications to those patients. We're seeing bills that would allow pharmacists to treat for substance use disorder or even HIV. We're also seeing bills that would allow optometrists to perform surgery, psychologists prescribing bills. We also have seen bills that would allow naturopaths to prescribe. We've seen a number of those this year. We're also seeing bills, of course, that would allow nurse practitioners and other advanced practice registered nurses, as well as physician assistants, to practice without any physician involvement. And again, these bills come back year after year, and we continue to work closely with the state medical associations and have already this year in providing resources and making sure that they have what they need at hand to be able to educate lawmakers about the importance of physician-led teams and push back against these inappropriate scope expansions.
Man, oh man, oh man. You know, there's an interesting thing with the scope, and there's a lesson that we can learn there, is that every state they win is another state that they can win. Every state they lose is another state that they can win, right? They just keep coming back and back and back, relentless, right? And we have to be the exact same way. And with your team, and what I'm seeing is that that's exactly what you're doing, right? Step by step, coming back every time. No, we're here, we're standing, and what we need are the state medical societies, the individual physicians to stand with you and with us so that we can defeat these bills, so that we can get great prior authorization legislation passed, so that we can get physician wellness policies and regulations passed, right? Teamwork makes the dream work. So this is awesome. Now we're going to go to another question here, right? So, I was reading this and I'm like, I kind of really want to know this. How are lawmakers addressing these issues? Any trends that you want to highlight who get down to the deep? I'm going to go Kim first and Emily then Daniel.
Thanks, Dr. Underwood. So two trends that I'll mention on the scope front. First, physician assistants. We have continued to see physician assistant bills that would replace physician supervision with a very weak definition of collaboration. And often what we're seeing is that this collaboration would be with an employer, not necessarily with a physician. And of course, this is inappropriate for a number of reasons. It effectively, as we view it, removes physicians from the care team. Employers don't practice medicine. They should not be the ones collaborating with a physician assistant. It also could end up resulting in employers telling physicians who and how they need to collaborate with or supervise. Physicians may not have a say then in the physician assistants that are part of their team, and they might not have a choice on what that collaboration or supervision looks like, and that's a problem. And the other side of that is, of course, that physician assistants might not know who to go to if they have a question about a specific patient. So there needs to be strong supervision or collaboration agreements in place for both the physicians and for the physician assistants, and of course, for the patients to make sure that they're receiving the highest quality care possible. The second trend that we are seeing, and I kind of already alluded to this, is pharmacists seeing a lot of test and treat bills that I mentioned earlier. And they're being introduced really at the same time that pharmacists, particularly those in the community setting, are saying, I don't have enough time in the day to do what I need to do to get my regular job done. Filling prescriptions, talking with and educating patients about their medications. 91% of pharmacists in chain settings rated their workload as high or excessively high. And 75% said they already have so much work to do that everything cannot be done well. So we don't want to add extra burdens onto pharmacists. And that's exactly what some of these bills would do. In addition to, of course, the fact that pharmacist education and training does not include performing a differential diagnosis or conducting physical examinations on patients. And of course, the CLIA wave test in and of itself is not enough to diagnose a patient. And then another trend that I'll mention is truth in advertising. I have to mention this, really a key cornerstone of a lot of the work that we do on scope of practice, which is really, and what truth in advertising is really about is making sure that all healthcare professionals put their license out there. They should wear name badges that include their license, include their credentials, include who they are. We want to make sure that there's truth and transparency in advertisement, making sure that it's clear to patients what the licensure is for the healthcare professionals that might be advertising, what they their education is behind that. And finally, and we've seen a couple states pass language on this recently, and that is making sure that specialty titles like cardiologists, like anesthesiologists, like dermatologists and urologists, that those are reserved for physicians. That is something that the AMA strongly supports. And we've got a couple states that have passed bills added on to their existing truth in advertising legislation to include those type of provisions. We have model legislation here as well and, you know, stand ready to work with state medical associations on that issue and really look forward to more states taking a lead on that issue.
Man, oh man. I mean, just think about it. right? You know, we're at a place now that we really have to have on our name badges that I'm a urologist, you know, that I'm a physician, that I'm the person they actually came there to see, that I'm the one that studied a decade, right? And that's just to get out and practice, but then read every day, do the CMEs, do all that so that I can be good at what I do and great at what I do. You know, I got to wear a badge that says, hey, by the way, that's me, right? Because someone else is saying, oh, that they're me, right? They're imposters. I mean, that's ridiculous.
You took care of the nation. It's time for the nation to take care of you. The AMA stood by America's physicians and patients during the pandemic, and we're not stopping there. We're fixing prior authorization, leading the charge on Medicare payment reform, supporting telehealth, fighting scope creep, and reducing physician burnout. It's time to rebuild, and the AMA is ready. To learn more about the AMA Recovery Plan for America's Physicians, go to ama-assn.org/time-to-rebuild.
All right, Emily.
I'm up. All right. Well, I'll just mention a couple trends that we're seeing in the states in the prior authorization reform legislation. The first being just sort of a reduction in the time it takes to get a response on prior authorization. The AMA's policy suggests that it should be as quick as 40, or it should be the longest it should be for urgent care is 24 hours, and for non-urgent care, 48 hours. We're seeing some of those bills pass in the states with those quick turnaround times. So we're really glad to see that. I'll also say there's, you know, kind of falling under that time and streamlining the process is automation. So using electronic prior authorization resources to make the process faster. But automation is a huge priority for the AMA. I will say it is not the end all be all of prior authorization reform. We're not just looking to get to know faster. We want to make sure, again, we're looking at volume. And I think that's sort of the next trend. So really reducing the volume of prior authorization, how often prior authorization is used. Some of the sort of volume reducing tools we're seeing are gold carding. So this is the idea that if you have a good or a high rate of approvals on your prior authorization requests, you're going to get a gold card and you're not going to have to do prior authorization for that service for a certain amount of time. A lot of states, I think we're up to 7 states, have been able to look at gold carding legislation or good gold carding laws and are starting to implement those programs. We're also seeing just generally identifying services or drugs that shouldn't have prior authorization at all. We've had a couple states say that generics should never have prior authorization and other services like that. So continue to support those efforts. We're also looking at and seeing a lot of states that are looking at the qualifications of the reviewer on the payer side. So making sure that the person who is determining medical necessity on the payer side is a qualified peer of the physician who's requesting it. So we would say that the person reviewing should be a physician licensed in the same state of the same specialty and with experience providing the care in question. So we've seen a lot of states that are able to get that similar language in law. We're also seeing a lot of data collection efforts, and I really love these efforts because I think so many of us consider the prior authorization process sort of a black box. We don't know what's being approved, what are certain specialties or certain services or certain drugs being targeted. So we're seeing a lot of states start to require payers to report prior authorization statistics either on their websites publicly or to insurance commissioners who then issue a report detailing what the prior authorization process in that state really looks like. So then we can sort of talk about the next steps doing more targeted prior authorization reform in those states based off of that data. We're also seeing a lot of kind of continuity of care provisions in the states. So I think particularly in our time of the Medicaid unwinding, we wanna make sure that patients as they switch plans or, come out of Medicaid and onto the private market, that they are not having to immediately get their prior authorization redone, that they can kind of continue their care during that transition time. So ensuring at least 90 days between the start of the new plan and the requirement that they go undergo a new prior authorization process. And then finally, we're just seeing a lot of transparency. So what are the clinical criteria that are being used to determine medical necessity in the prior authorization process? What drugs and services actually require prior authorization? These are things that are surprisingly opaque for a lot of payers and to a lot of physicians. So we're just trying to really kind of lift the curtain on some of these practices and get to really know what's going on from the payer side. So up there.
I'm going to repeat something you said. I loved it. We are not working to get to know faster. No.
Big reform effort.
Correct. Because some of that, as you push these reforms forward, they will find themselves in a position that they may realize that the best thing to do is to just get rid of it altogether.
Yes.
Right. And that's really where we're part of the where we're headed. Okay, you love it, then let's make it better. It's a headache to make it better. Let's just get rid of it because we really don't love it. We just use it because we can make money with it, right? But let's fix it. All right, cool. Awesome. Daniel, make it happen, baby.
Thanks, Andrew. I want to pick up on something Emily said about, we don't just have to, legislators, regulators, hospitals, health systems, credentialing organizations. One of the trends that we have found is that sometimes they ask questions because they've done it for a long time and they don't know why they're asking questions anymore. And so what we have found is, importantly, greater awareness and greater discussion among legislators, regulators, and others, and leaders in hospitals and health systems, that there's a lot that can be done at every level to better support physician wellness. And again, I'm going to focus a little bit on the questions here, because once we've had those discussions about removing stigmatizing questions on licensing and credentialing applications, or in legislatures the last two or three sessions, we've helped establish physician wellness programs. The regulators and legislators are almost always supportive. We have had near unanimous passage of laws in Virginia, South Dakota, Arizona, Kentucky, Indiana, Delaware. These are red, blue, and purple states. So this is not a partisan issue. We've worked with large national health systems such as HCA Healthcare and Envision to revise their credentialing questions throughout their system, affecting hundreds of thousands of physicians. We've also worked with, regional systems in Virginia, the entire Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Our hats are off to the Massachusetts Hospital Association and the Massachusetts Medical Society and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, who, with the AMA and others, we all came together to make those commitments for the hospitals and health systems in Massachusetts to make that commitment to revise their applications to remove all of the stigmatizing language that we've discussed, positively affecting more than 30,000 physicians. But we've also done it in Johnsbury, Vermont, small little hospital, in Johnsbury, Vermont, that help everything there. So, and there's an important bill in the Minnesota legislature up for hearing on Thursday, where, thanks to the Minnesota Medical Association, hopefully these questions will be removed through all credentialing bodies in the state of Minnesota. So, but at the same time, there are some medical boards and health systems, Dr. Underwood, that continue to hold on to the harmful belief that they just want to know if somebody has ever been in treatment. And when we dig down and we say, well, why do you want to know? And they say, well, we just want to know. And we point out the data that show, 40 to 50% of medical students and physicians say, we do not seek care because we are afraid of disclosing that to a medical licensing board or an employer. And the medical boards and employers will say, well, we want to know if somebody's in treatment so we can help them. And we say, well, this is a problem here. We're at cross purposes. People are not going to seek care if you tell them that you're going to be watching over them. So we have to find that balance and we have to work through that fear that can cause situations to worsen, potentially debilitating illness. There are, you know, about 50% of medical students say that they either personally know or know of another medical student who has considered death by suicide. So we want to avoid these tragedies. And, you know, thankfully, almost everybody we talk to understands this. And, you know, those that don't, we continue to have conversations to work through this, because these aren't necessarily the easiest conversations to have. But we do this on a regular basis, you know, again, in partnership with many organizations. And we're going to continue to do it because, you know, the stakes are high.
Dr. Underwood, can I jump here really quickly? Because I know you know this, but, you know, we've just done a round robin with these three folks on our team. And I just cannot emphasize enough to physicians in this country how, like, incredible this work is. So when you talk about trends, for example, in prior authorization, those, first of all, many of those trends and the movement in those trends planted by Emily Carroll 6, 7, 8 years ago. This is a relentless year in, year out effort when it comes to prior authorization, bringing the physician voice forward, the patient voices forward to regulators at that National Association of Insurance Commissioners that I was talking about before. That's just one example. Daniel, you know, nobody told him he needed to go to the systems. Nobody told him that he needed to go work with the medical boards. He did that. He took that upon himself. The energy, the passion behind the work with Kim and Scope of Practice, the most funded, well-oiled machine campaign that we have. Every trend that pops up, we are ready because people like Kim have devoted time and effort monitoring trends across the country, developing resources, model bills, workforce mappers, seeking out studies to counter the narratives that are put out by our non-physician provider colleagues at the national level, debunking myths. This is what we do day in, day out across the country. And I just think, you know, this is the story that's not told very often. We are a small group in the AMA, but I think we are a mighty group. And I cannot emphasize enough that it's only because of our collaboration with state medical associations. And if physicians are frustrated, upset, join your medical association, join the AMA. We need your voice. You're the best salesman on this, Dr. Underwood, but we cannot do this work without you all. We are incredibly passionate, and we will fight relentlessly for patients and physicians.
Yes. I'm going to tell you, you know, thank you, Kai, because your team has worked its tail off, right, to make these things a reality for us. Are we winning every single battle? No, because that's not reality of life. But however, we will win more if more of us puts up, get in the game, get in the fight, bring our money to the table, our bodies to the table, our resources to the table, that we show up day in and day out and we're relentless. Yes, we can have more victories.
That wraps up the first part of this two-part series. Don't miss the next part of this conversation. Subscribe to Moving Medicine today. Thanks for listening.